the LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Presentations and interviews with leading attorneys and industry professionals. On this edition, Frank Aquila of Sullivan & Cromwell on M&A due diligence. The opinions expressed by guests interviewed on LexisNexis Legal Podcasts do not necessarily reflect those of Reed Elsevier Incorporated, LexisNexis, subsidiary companies, shareholders, employees, or customers, and should not be considered legal advice. Frank Aquila is a partner in the Sullivan & Cromwell LLP Mergers and Acquisitions Group. His practice focuses on mergers, acquisitions, strategic alliances, and corporate governance matters for large, multinational corporations. Mr. Aquila was an American Lawyer Dealmaker of the Year in 2009 and is the 2010 recipient of the Atlas Award as the Global M&A Lawyer of the Year. Mr. Aquila has also received Burton Awards for Legal Achievement in 2005 and 2010. He received his A.B. degree from Columbia University and his J.D. degree from Brooklyn Law School. And he's recently written the Emerging Issues Analysis, Top 10 Considerations When Doing M&A Due Diligence, which is available from LexisNexis. Mr. Aquila, as always, it's a pleasure to have you with us on this LexisNexis Legal Podcast.
Thanks, Steve. It's my pleasure to be with you discussing some interesting issues.
And this time around, it's Top Considerations When Doing M&A Due Diligence. Why that topic?
Well, Steve, one of the things I found, and I've been doing M&A transactions for a long time, is that there is a new focus on due diligence. I think that, and this sort of is cyclical, whenever you have issues with the economy or slowdowns in M&A, when companies start coming back into the M&A market, they enter a little bit more cautiously, and they're focused more on due diligence than they might have been previously. And by the way, I will tell you, I think that that is a good thing, because some of the mistakes that get made in acquisitions really could have been remedied by having a good due diligence process. And that's really what Melissa Sawyer, my partner, and I wrote about in this article, sort of the key things that companies should be thinking about.
Now, there's a difference in due diligence in a M&A transaction as opposed to a securities transaction, right?
Steve, you're raising an excellent point. And traditionally, due diligence has meant the work that lawyers and bankers did in connection with the securities offering. And the objective in due diligence for a securities offering is to make sure that you're disclosing anything that's material about the company and to establish for the parties, to the extent available, what's called the due diligence defense to any securities liabilities. So that's what you're looking at and you're thinking about in the securities context. The M&A context is very, very different, and it's actually far more complicated and far more nuanced. Let me give you a bit of an overview. You're looking at, how do I value the company? You're looking at, are there any skeletons in the closet that would make me decide not to go forward? You're trying to look at, what are the issues you're going to have to deal with if you proceed forward with the deal? Are there change of control provisions? Are there joint ventures with third parties that you're going to have to renegotiate? Is there debt that you're going to have to refinance? You're also, and I think the best acquirers are those that when they start the due diligence process, not only are they looking at negotiation of the transaction and completion of the transaction, but they're actually going the next step and saying, if I buy this company, how am I going to integrate it into my current business? How am I going to utilize it? Which people do I want to keep? Which people are not going to remain as part of the company? So I think that when acquirers really look at it from, do I want to purchase? If I purchase, how much am I willing to pay, and do I need to have a holdback for liabilities or things of that sort? And then if I do acquire it, how I'm going to best integrate and utilize the assets, and that very much includes the people that come along with the business in going forward post-closing. I think if you look at due diligence from that sort of 360-degree viewpoint, you can see why it's so important and why I believe it's crucial really to success and failure in M&A transactions.
More than just bricks and mortar.
Absolutely.
What are some of the key objectives for M&A due diligence?
First and foremost, you want to learn as much as you can about the business. Now, if it's a strategic buyer, you know, cosmetics company A buying cosmetics company B, presumably the potential buyer knows a lot about the business and probably knows a lot about the target company. It's different, of course, if you have a financial buyer, a private equity buyer who knows a lot about deals but may know less about a particular company or about a particular industry. The thing that I say to strategic buyers is that while they should utilize whatever information they have about the company going into the process, at the same time, what they should be doing is not making any assumptions that they know everything about the company just because they've studied them as a competitor. They need to really think about learning everything they can. That's something that the private equity folks do a really good job of in due diligence. So clearly, you want to learn as much as you can. Then secondly, what you want to be doing is trying to determine what provisions you're going to need in the contract. You know, if it's a public company, obviously it's more, you know, of a walk-away type of an issue. But in a private transaction, you're going to be thinking about closing conditions, what sort of representations and warranties you have, what sort of post-closing indemnities you're going to have. As I mentioned a second ago, whether or not you're going to have a holdback, you know, basically keeping part of the consideration in escrow until after you've sort of tested some of these liabilities. Sometimes there may be an earnout if, you know, the buyer says that they think they should be paid 10 times and you say, no, we're willing to pay 8 times earnings or whatever the metric is. But to the extent that you can establish, well, if you meet certain hurdles, then we're willing to pay you more post-closing. You know, these are the type of things that you're thinking about. And one of the things you want to be doing, and this is something that I talk to clients about a lot, is making sure that the process is holistic, that you're including all the right people in it, that when you're doing financial due diligence, the lawyers know what's going on. When you're doing legal due diligence, that the bankers and the financial people know what's going on, because that cross-fertilization will lead to a far better outcome.
What are some of the biggest mistakes that are made in M&A due diligence?
I think the biggest issue for me is siloing. That is, you have the tax people doing tax due diligence, the environmental people doing the environmental due diligence, the marketing people doing the marketing due diligence, and they all do it in their own silo. And there's no discussion across the various disciplines. The reason that that is so harmful is that you can learn about something in IP due diligence that might have a financial or legal liability component to it. And hopefully, of course, that's going to be communicated up or over. But sometimes when teams work in strict silos, there's not that communication. And then you get to the final negotiation and suddenly you say, hey, I never knew there was this liability, or I never knew there was this problem. And they say, what are you talking about? You know, we fully disclosed that to your environmental team 3 weeks ago. And here's, you know, everything we showed you, and it's in the data room. And so that, for me, is the biggest mistake. Other mistakes are to have a very thorough process, but somehow not either communicate it to the negotiation team or not be sure that those issues are reflected in the agreement. You know, one of the things that I can tell you as somebody who's sat at the negotiation table and has drafted agreements is that if there's a particular issue or problem, whether it's discovered in due diligence or it's just a business issue, whatever it may be, that I can only reflect that in the agreement. I can only negotiate around that issue to the extent that I'm aware of it. And again, so it's a corollary really to the siloing. I think the other big mistake that is made is not understanding materiality. And by that, what I mean is that if you're doing a $10 billion deal and there's a $50,000 problem and it really just has no other implication than you might have to pay $50,000, that's probably not material. Now, of course, 100 of those $50,000 problems, that's another story. But very often in due diligence, you know, it's, oh my God, the CEO got a parking ticket, you know, with the company car. And, you know, is that really a huge issue? Obviously not. But if there's a pattern of everybody in the company is getting parking tickets with their company cars, well, you know, then maybe you should look further. So it's sort of understanding what's material, what's relevant, and what's important in the negotiations.
You've mentioned things like IP due diligence and tax due diligence. Is there a vendor due diligence?
Well, you know, vendor due diligence is really a phrase that we talk about and have picked up from the UK. And in the UK, it's fairly standard when you're selling a subsidiary or selling a company, you in effect do due diligence on yourself first. And I think it's a pretty good concept because what that means is that when you actually allow the other party or multiple parties, if it's an auction process, to do due diligence on the company, you've already done a thorough review. You have a very fulsome data room. And today, most of these data rooms, if not all of them, are electronic, so it's all online. So you've done that. And what's more important is you know what the issues are that they are going to discover and focus on in due diligence. And so therefore, you can be available and able to respond to those questions. The worst thing that can happen is that they learn something in due diligence that really is of limited value or limited liability, but when you find out about it, you as the seller or representing the seller don't know. And so by doing due diligence on yourself, on the target company, it really prepares you to negotiate. It prepares you to guide the other side through due diligence because 9 times out of 10, most issues you come up with in due diligence are not fatal. They may need to be discussed, they may need to be negotiated around, but they're not fatal. So the sooner you know about it, the sooner you can present the right information, the better it's going to be for the entire process.
Now, are there major constraints in due diligence? I mean, what is the confidentiality and antitrust considerations that have to be taken into consideration?
That's another very important thing to think about, and it's important to explain to, because sometimes you'll say to your team, okay, we're going to do diligence on this particular company, and you know the team who you've worked with and is very good and very experienced pulls out their due diligence checklist, and they say, okay, we're going to look at all these different things with respect to this particular target. Well, if someone's selling a division and it's an auction process being run by an investment banker, then in that situation, it is perfectly reasonable to think that you can sort of have access to the right people and have all the documents. However, if it's a public company and confidentiality there is going to be very, very important, the number of people at the target company is probably going to be very limited. There, you're probably going to have to do more of a confirmatory due diligence process rather than a full deep dive. Having said that, though, since it's a public company, you're going to be relying on their SEC filings and other public filings, and you're just really going to be doing more confirmation. The other constraint is, and this is clearly more of an issue with strategic buyers than private equity buyers, but and even there, there's sometimes an issue, but what you're looking at is a situation where if two competitors are thinking about merging or one acquiring the other, you have to be sensitive to the fact that they are, in fact, competitors or potential competitors. And as a result, the antitrust laws require that competitors can't just freely share information with each other. Now, there's ways of dealing with it, and clean rooms, and confidentiality agreements, and having, you know, certain people who are not involved in day-to-day operations look at it, which you can go into a whole long detail. But you have to be sensitive to those constraints and what the antitrust constraints are. Also with litigation, they may have a great case, but they may not be able to fully disclose everything about it because they can't breach attorney-client privilege. So there are constraints, and the sooner you understand what they are, the quicker I think you can develop an approach that gets around them.
Speaking of information and available information, with the amount of information that is now available via the internet, can you do any meaningful due diligence utilizing public sources?
You can. Clearly, with a public company, you certainly have all their public filings, and that's a very good starting point. Even with a non-public company, whether it's a private company or a company which is a division of a public company or division of another company, on the internet, you can get tons of information. You certainly can get legal databases about, liens and litigation and things of that sort. And then just generally utilizing Bing and Google and, various other sources, you can find a lot of information out. The point I would make, whether you find positive things or negative things about a company through the internet, is that is something that you should be then, in the formal due diligence process, asking a question about. You shouldn't assume that just because it's in the public domain that it is absolutely accurate. And it may have been accurate when it was published 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, or 2 months ago, but it's not totally accurate today. And so while the internet allows you to think about what the issues are, understand the company better, know what people out in the wider world are thinking about that company, at the end of the day, though, it's not a real substitute for actual due diligence.
So you've gathered all of this information and material. How then do you best use the information learned in due diligence?
A couple of different things. One is to make sure that the right issues are reflected in the contract. And if there is an agreement with a big supplier or customer that has a change of control provision or is in default, you may need to have a provision in your agreement that says, we don't have to close unless, that contract's been extended or that party has waived their rights in the agreement or whatever. So you want to utilize it in the agreement. Secondly, most agreements have disclosure schedules to it. And basically what you want to make sure is that every item that is reflected on the disclosure schedules, you've seen and learned about in due diligence. So you want to basically do the sort of tick and tie to make sure that, and if there are things that you've learned about in due diligence that you would expect or want to be on those schedules, ask and understand why they're not being reflected in those schedules. And as I mentioned at the outset of this, that you want to start thinking about getting your human resources people and the integration team thinking about and using this information so that day one post-closing, you can really begin that integration process. Because every day wasted in integration is a day that you don't get back, and there's a lot of information and due diligence that's going to help you get there.
How has M&A due diligence changed over the years?
Well, I think like every part of the M&A market, it has become more and more sophisticated and more institutionalized over the passage of time. As I mentioned, you know, you do see ebbs and flows in terms of what people want to do with respect to due diligence and how much they want to do. But beyond that, clearly it's become more sophisticated. I think there are many more outside resources. Clearly, you know, many of the accounting firms have groups that are dedicated to this. I think most major law firms that do a lot of M&A have, you know, teams of people who are experienced and know how to do it and do it quickly. I would say, just from, you know, my own Sullivan & Cromwell perspective, we probably can extract double the information in half the time today than we could even 5 or 6 or 10 years ago.
As we get ready to wrap up here, what do you want to leave listeners with? Is there a takeaway from this, from your perspective?
Well, I think, Steve, what I would say is clearly with the amount of cash that's on the balance sheets of major companies, we're going to see a real increase in M&A as we go into 2011. And so I think practitioners, even if M&A is not part of their core practice, are going to be faced with many of these challenges, are going to be involved in these processes. And what I would just say to any lawyer who's heading up a due diligence process is really think about all these different issues, discuss with the client what their objectives are, and then try to formulate a plan that meets those objectives, and then make sure, of course, you're communicating to your team what the plan is, what the expectations are, and ultimately what those objectives are. And if you do that, you will be 95% of the way there towards doing a good and effective due diligence program.
Sounds like good advice. Frank Aquila, top 10 considerations when doing M&A due diligence. Thank you for your views and your insights and for being part of this LexisNexis Legal Podcast.
Thank you, Steve.
Frank Aquila of Sullivan & Cromwell. Thank you for listening to this LexisNexis Legal Podcast. Visit the LexisNexis communities at www.lexisnexis.com/community. The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast, copyright 2010 by LexisNexis, a division of Reed Elsevier Incorporated. LexisNexis. I'm Steve Bursler. Thank you for listening.